Longtime fans of the show should be familiar with the lender formerly known as Sue Pullen, and I'm pleased to announce that she's back, fresh off a rebrand and ready to help as Sue Mackey. Sue is a certified mortgage advisor at Fairway Independent Mortgage, an equal housing lender who focuses on finding the right product for you and your needs. She has over 20 years of experience helping thousands of homeowners. Whether it's purchasing, refinancing, or even a reverse mortgage, Sue will help. Sue's licensed in 36 states now, so reach out and let Sue Mackey it happen for you. The best way to reach her is just give her a call at 520-977-7904 or in an email, spullen@fairwaymc.com. Fairway Independent Mortgage has an MLS number of 2289. Sue Mackey has an MLS number of 206048. That email again, spullen@fairwaymc.com. And that phone number is 520-977-7904. Shoot Sue an email and let her know she needs to update that address. Disclaimer time. This is where I tell everyone to lighten up. It's just a podcast. Trading is like that roller coaster at the amusement park. Thrilling, unpredictable, and potentially stomach churning. What works for one person might leave another clutching their hat in the wind. Our hosts and guests, they're awesome, knowledgeable, full of insights, but we're not financial advisors. So don't rush to make any investment decisions based solely on our banter. Always consult with a professional or do your own research. Plus, let's face it, we like to have fun, laugh, enjoy the trading ride together. It's all in the name of good podcasting fun. So remember, take it easy, don't bet the farm, and keep your seatbelts on at all times. Thank you for listening. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the China Shop, home of the Band of Traders podcast, and also known as the Brick Breaker Club. I'm your host, Kyle, and joining me tonight from Vonta Trading, we've got Mr. Banks and Bear Goes Long, along with our special guest, friend and economist, Eric Mason. Since we're lucky enough to get the top economist in New England on tonight's show, we're going to have more of an open forum.
Is he coming on later?
Well, maybe we'll let Eric take a big crap on bricks. Maybe we'll discuss trading bonds. Maybe we'll spend an inordinate amount of time dissecting the symbolisms depicted on medieval banners. I don't know, and you're going to have to listen to find out. Before I open up the mics, let's get the self-promotion crap out of the way. So for us, coming out on Thursday, we got an episode with Dan Passarelli. And then following that, there will be the next installment of our economic series featuring Banks, myself, and Eric. You can follow us on Twitter at FinancialInept1, or you can join the Discord if you want to get updates or send in suggestions for future topics and guests. And you can visit bandoftraderspodcast.com to browse the guest directory, check out the deals and discounts we collected over the years, and stay up to date on all the latest miniseries. Banks, you got anything to report over at Vanta?
Nothing particularly new. Obviously we just changed the Discord around a little bit. We went down in our monthly rate to $35 a month, kind of opening up the Discord, get, you know, more people involved. And, I think it's been, more lively and, I think it's been great over there the last, week or two.
It's been really awesome. The engagement's been picking up. I've been loving it. Eric, you got any live events coming up that we can heckle you at?
Yeah, first of all, I always love heckling. March 30th, I'm doing a TEDx talk in Boston. For some reason, they still haven't let us release the organization doing it. So we're hoping that maybe the next week.
Still doing their background checks on you?
Yeah, hopefully, which means that they probably won't let me talk. That would be the smart move. But you can follow me at Eric James Mason on Twitter, and I'll keep that updated. Or follow me on LinkedIn, because I still use LinkedIn because I'm 75 years old.
I still put stuff on LinkedIn every now and then. I do more on LinkedIn than I do on Instagram. Yeah. What about you, Bear? Got anything to share with the group, or where can people follow you?
I mean, the most active place I am is at Goes Bear on Twitter, under or search for Bear Goes Long. And make sure to check out the recent interview with Kyle and Cleo that was published.
Oh, God. Yeah. That was a good one. Yeah. I'll make sure I link that one. Appreciate it. All that stuff, actually. We'll put that in the links. But I think for now, we just open up the microphones and just kind of have kind of a free for all here. So anything economics related is on the table. If anybody wants any questions they want to ask or they want to talk about.
Slightly off topic. When I logged in for the pre-show, I heard people talk about firefighters, and I am repping my Quincy Fire Department swag. So I don't know what we were talking about firefighters, but I'm all in on that.
Bear is actually a volunteer firefighter, right?
Yeah, I'm a volunteer firefighter. Oh, and then literally today, I just got the email. I passed my EMT test yesterday.
So, oh, congratulations.
Thank you. Awesome. Congrats. I'm now a firefighter EMT.
Woo. Awesome. Just Just got back from the celebration dinner too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I went out for a nice prime rib.
No.
I added to the economy, the local economy.
Yeah. Okay, now challenging question. How do you get your prime rib cooked?
Oh, God.
Rare.
I do my prime. I slice it into a ribeye and then put it on the grill. That's how I do mine.
Oh, I like that.
Not a big fan of prime rib. I feel like it's got just like a little bit of flavor on the rings where the smoke penetrates, and the rest of it is just kind of bland to me.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's why I like my horseradish. But
I do love horseradish, though. That's
yeah, that's a good call.
But yeah, that's my secret steak tip is I buy the 20-pound packers of boneless ribeye at Costco, and then you put them in the fridge and you wet age them because they'll sit in that vacuum sealed bag for months.
Yeah,
wet age them in there, and then I pull them out and slice them up into steaks.
Nice.
My grandfather was a chef for 50 years, and whenever he'd be sitting in a restaurant and hear somebody order like a well-done prime rib, just enraged him. World War II never really bothered that man. Well-done prime rib, rage.
I got one of my daughters who'll eat a steak the proper way. The other one always wants it well done. So I always get her like a top sirloin. The other one gets to eat the New York prime strips with me.
Going to a steakhouse tomorrow night for dinner, so maybe I'll go. I don't know. Maybe I'll go ribeye. I do very much like ribeyes.
Porterhouse is always good too.
Yeah, ribeye's got everything you need. All the nutritional quality or nutritional value your body needs. There we go.
Yeah, hey man. You know, ironic to kind of this discussion when it comes to a little bit on the fire department. We're getting ready to sell like a $5.2 million firefighter bond for a new fire apparatus at the city, and it's taken us 28 months just to get a new ladder truck, like to have it built from the ground up.
Yep.
Jeez.
These supply chains are nuts. Like 28 months. When I first started, we were like 9 months to get a custom built ladder truck, and they were like $1 million. Now we're paying just for a ladder truck $2.1 million in 28 months. It's crazy.
Yeah. So our both of our ambulances are 20 years old, 18 and 20 years old. And we got a state grant because we have no funding. We get no tax funding. It's all self-funded donations. So we got a state grant to buy a new ambulance 3 years ago. And the latest is it will be delivered in May.
God.
And $170,000 for an empty ambulance, just the shell. And then it's going to cost us another $100,000 to put the equipment inside of there.
We bought fire trucks a little while ago, and I got a bill afterwards, and they were like, "Oh yeah, we need $200,000, Eric, to outfit it." And I was like, "Why didn't include that when we bought it? That would have been cool. Like, what's the point of the empty fire truck?"
Nope.
By the way, one of the things I love about local government, I now know how much a Jaws of Life costs, like $45,000. I was like, "This is a cheap one. There's an $80,000 version." I was like, "Well, first off, I kind of want the $80,000 version if we have to use it, but it's really expensive."
Well, okay, so but then electric or hydraulic?
I think this was hydraulic. Funny thing, after I complained about not knowing that ahead of time, there's a car crash right in front of City Hall. I even have a video of it, and I got to watch them use it. And I was like, all right, now I feel weird complaining about this. I'm happy we have it.
No, find out the next time they're doing a training session and go out there. It's a lot of fun. We do it about 3 times a year. We buy a junk car and slice it up and practice. It's fun.
We have one of those tiller ladder trucks, where like the Kramer drives it in the back style. And the fire chief, our fire chief's awesome, man. He's one of my favorite people. He's a gold, he's also a gold glove boxer, which is just my favorite thing in the world. Cool. But that type of attitude, guy's amazing. He's wicked young too. He's like in his late 40s, sorry, he's fire chief. And he said to me, I'm the guy who goes up there. City council is wicked supportive of fire trucks, but like I'm the guy who goes up there and argues for it. And we recently did this new system for new kits to try and reduce some of the cancer rate firefighters and these like fancy wash machines too. So I'm usually like the guy who goes up there and says all the math numbers when we're up there. And he's like, "You got to come down here and drive the tiller truck." And I grew up in an auto body shop, so fire truck's like top one thing I want to drive. I'm just scared we're going to break it. I'm the person who has to pay for it if I break it. That just scares me.
Well, now you know how much it costs.
That's what's scary about it. I see those guys speeding. I'm like, slow down. You guys are expensive. What do you think you're driving?
one of our neighboring fire departments has actually rolled 2 trucks in the last 3 years. Hitting corners too fast.
Sounds like they got
Purdue's
employees driving for them.
I think you're right.
Eric, you mentioned the selling a $5 million bond to pay for this truck. Can you kind of walk us through that process? Because I think when you do bond trading, like, you're like an originator, right? So it's different than like some of the other guys here that trade the futures on it.
Yeah. So I'm like, so we're 100% right, Kyle. So we're considered originators by the feds, by specifically IRS. So it's a pretty lengthy process. It's like heavily legally involved. It's way more legal than finance, to be honest. It starts like due diligence calls where I basically get on a call with all my with a bunch of attorneys who write my preliminary offertory statement. Mm-hmm. And then that rolls into a ratings call with S&P. And we're in the market like four times a year. So most municipalities are only in the market like once a year, once every 2 years. So we actually follow like a corporate issuance cycle. But really, it's like a composition bond. So it's $5.2 million. I'm going to be spending about $4.4 million on the ladder truck and then two fire engines. Mm-hmm. And then I need another $600,000, give or take, for the equipment to outfit each one of those trucks. And then I'm going to need another like couple $100,000 to outfit the stations because, Quincy's wicked old. We're celebrating our 400th anniversary next year. So all of our fire trucks are never built for apparatus. Yeah, we're wicked old. So a lot of our firehouses weren't built for Quincy was 260 years old when the first like professional fire company was formed in the United States. So we have to re-support our fire truck or like the fire stations where the trucks go. So the fire trucks will bond them out for like 20 years. The equipment's 10 years and the public building improvements like 10 to 20 years. So we have to create this like ombre approach because we do negotiated debt. So unlike competitive debt offerings, which most municipalities do where everybody just whatever the whims of the day of the market are, mm-hmm. Everybody puts in their offer. We rip their offer. I mean, literally we rip open their offers. And then whoever has the lowest price wins, we negotiate. So mm-hmm. we start about 8 o'clock, 2 weeks before we'll start marketing. Marketing it to different providers. We use a company, our primary underwriters, this company called Ramirez and Company out of New York. They're fantastic. We'll go through that process. They do a lot of advertisement. The day of around 9 a.m., they open up. We usually have a kickoff call. We have this thing called Game Day, mm-hmm. Which shows every available tranche that somebody can buy into at each day's mark. And then we bid it. We take all the calls. We're usually 5 to 8 times oversubscribed. And then over the course of the morning, we will crank down that interest rate. And don't forget, I mean, you guys all know this. They're bonds. The coupon rate's fixed on them. We're not changing mm-hmm. the coupon rate. We're negotiating on premium here.
Okay.
And we crank up that premium demand. So we lower the net interest costs or true interest costs, depending on how you want to look at it. And we cut that 8 times over subscription down to about as close as we can to 1. And it's actually really cool. So you get on a call around noon, 12:30, and you sit down and you have one of the people from your underwriters will be like, all right. And they'll read off the spreads. They'll email to you before, mm-hmm. a couple minutes before. Do you accept the spread at this? Do you accept the rate at this? Do you accept the rate at this? And you say, yes, 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 yes. And every yes you say is millions of dollars in some cases to that agreement.
So you're basically like playing a game of chicken with all the potential buyers. You're like, oh, okay, everybody wants it for this. Okay, how about now? Do you still want it?
Yeah, we'll talk chicken. We went into the market when Russia invaded Ukraine. So what was that? Oh my God, that was like almost 2 years ago. And we stayed in the market and everybody left. It was obviously a horrible situation, but it was everybody left the market. And one of our co-underwriters at the time, this company called Drexel Hamilton, they're a veteran-owned firm. And, they
awesome.
Mixed with Ramirez Company, who really knows this stuff. It was fantastic to really know when you have people who know what they're doing. Like I'm a schmuck. Like, dude, I could build you a great econometric model. You want to do some IV or some diff and diff or RDD, I'm your man. But that true type of financial professional, I mean, they saved the city, we were in the market for $77 million. I mean, they saved the city at least $2 million in interest.
Wow.
Because, when the world goes to shit, it's a flight to safety. And we were one of the only guys selling. Everybody else retreated. So it worked. But it was scary, man, because it's like we didn't know. We thought we were going to hit way outside our margins on that. We did, but we ended up hitting under, which helped.
I think he just made a fan with ProShot. He wants you to say less about Ivy. He's already in.
I made Discord up. What's the...
Click on the little chat button. You should be able to see people firing out things. Yeah, if you guys got questions in the audience there, just type them in. We'll let Eric go free-for-all style here.
Don't do that.
So the bonds that you're selling from the city, they're tax-advantaged for the buyers?
Yeah, yeah. So they, in most cases, so unless we do a lot of development in Quincy, we have about we have a downtown district that, you know, it's had about $1 billion in private investment going there. So we have about $250 million in bonds down there under something called a DIF, district improvement financing. And that you got to be careful with because you have private use. So weird, guys, weird thing. And I'm full disclosure, I'm on Tulsa University, has an energy studies. So I'm obviously a little biased. I'm on their board. And so everybody wants to put solar panels everywhere. Mm-hmm. Like that's everybody wants to put solar panels everywhere. All right. Now we sell tax-free bonds in most cases, unless there's a private use component. Now, when you do a school, say Massachusetts, my school's cost me $100 million, give or take, right? Food service in the school. So that's a private company that uses, you know, our cafeteria area to bring in food. Mm-hmm. That's what most places do. All right. So that takes up your cafeteria. It takes up, say, 7% of your building. You're only allowed to have anywhere from 10 to 15% of that private use of that bond. So only 10 to 15% of that building can have people who are making profit on it. All right. Mm. So cafeteria takes up 7%. So they'll be like, oh, hey, we're going to put solar panels everywhere. Like, I have solar panels in my house. Like, I'm not anti-solar panel. They won't talk to me and they'll be like, oh, we're looking to put solar panels on. I'm like, if you do that, I have to reissue an $80 million bond. I sold that as tax free. They're like, yeah, but it's good. I'm like, no, because unless the city buys the solar panels and puts them on there and manages that energy, which is not how that works in the United States. It's net metering is what every municipality does pretty much across the country. You actually incur you actually force a bond to be taxable, which is like 150 basis point increase, let alone like $100 million, $100 million. I'm probably running $1.5 million, $2 million in issuance costs. Wow. So I'm sitting there like, ah, oh, guys, be careful, be careful. Like more solar panels, that's fine, but we need to, there's ways to get around this. But yeah, it's, it can be a little scary that people don't think that.
Is that because you can sell energy back? Because it, is that really the only reason?
Yeah, so like we'll have a company, okay, exactly. So we can sell company, we could, the company comes there, establishes it, we kind of rent the usage of those solar panels, all right? They collect 100% of that energy benefit, mm-hmm. and then they pay us for effectively 20% of that usage, of that tariff is what they call it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we pay 80% of what our energy bill would have been.
Right.
But then the IRS gets even weirder. So we have the National Park Service in Quincy area. We have the Adams Presidential Estates. You know, John Quincy Adams and John Adams built. Actually, my office shares.
Just put that together. Is that who you're named after?
No, so we're actually named after John Quincy, which is John Quincy Adams' grandfather.
Okay, okay.
So, like, I share a building with John Adams' office he had during when he was John Quincy Adams when he was in the House of Reps, and like the promenade that connects like the city of Quincy's, you know, like City Hall, mm-hmm. public, like civic space, actually has where the presidents are buried. Oh. So like every day I walk by like John Quincy Adams and John Adams' grave, which is like, you know, that's, you know, in all seriousness, that's like those two people were some of the greatest public servants the U.S. has ever had. And it's a cool reminder to walk by them. But
that they're dead. No, I'm just kidding. That they're dead.
So we've talked about working with the National Park Service.
Yeah.
The IRS told us, if you have the National Park Service in there, they're considered a private entity. And if they take up more than 15% of the building, the bonds will be taxable. And I'm like, you are the National Park Service federal government. What do you mean? You are them.
Well, just stick all the solar panels in the cafeteria and you double the, yeah, that's only 7%, right? Contract, yeah, there you go. God damn.
Government's so with this, weird. With the solar panels, you're essentially just renting out the roof space and you basically take it on a subtenant rather than net metering it just against your energy costs.
Yeah. But we rent space in Plain Ridge, Mass. Like we rent like a solar farm essentially. And exactly what you're saying, Bear, where that's normally how it's done. But we're really trying to maximize, you know, square feet. Mm-hmm. And so now it's like retroactively mm-hmm. want to put it on buildings. And that's where the problem comes. If it was just net metering out in the middle of nowhere, sorry for Plain Ridge, I called you middle of nowhere, but like that would be much easier.
I think they'll be fine.
They got a casino out there; they're doing fine.
Yeah, there
you go. Yeah, I mean it's really kind of fascinating because otherwise the city would have to own the solar panels and then they have to hire the people to come in and manage them and take care of them and do all that stuff.
I used to work for a regional bank, and, you know, we got approached by some companies doing the same thing, going, hey, you know, we want to rent the roofs on your branches. So we could put solar panels on there. I was like, yeah, okay, that's an interesting business opportunity.
Banks.
Just go around renting roofs.
Anybody ever approach you guys?
Yeah, so I can't name the company because we got litigated. We're going to get litigated against it. They are litigating against me, or they don't like me in general. But we were like, yo, man, you can come. It's a huge company that you guys can probably all guess who it is once I tell the story. But if this ever gets brought up, I can say, like, at least I have no idea I never brought up the company. So we're like, yo, you guys want solar panels up here? And they're like, yeah, we're super fun. Let's go do this. And they drilled through my – trying to give them swearing for Lent, so I'm going to stop. But, like, they drilled through my 110-year-old roof.
Wow.
And it flooded and destroyed a bunch of underlying. And then we were like, yo, man, what the hell happened? They were like, yeah, we didn't install that. The contract did it. And I was like, yeah, I'm gonna introduce you to a legal concept called subvendors. Right. You and your gotta be careful because this is, I can't see how but they were like, oh well, it's our problem. So we ripped off the solar panels and, like, threw them off to the side because it's destroying the freaking roof. And they called us up like, yeah, we're not getting any energy off the roof. Well, like, yeah, no crap, because your freaking solar panels are sitting in the parking lot. So I'm probably like 23, 24 years old. We're in a conference room. There's all these, like, muckmucks around there. I'm an idiot. Like, I'm just a dumb guy in general. So they're like, all right, like, the city has to pay this amount of money, and we'll give the city this amount of money, and back and forth, back and forth. And they're like, so they're coming up with a discount rate. So I was like, all right. So I went and sat down and did the math. And I was like, all right, our discount rate at the time was 1.7% because that's what tips were. And, you know, we don't invest in the broad market. So this Silicon Valley bro is like, oh, it should be like 9.5%. I'm like, dude, when is 9.5% a guaranteed rate of return? So we're going back and forth, and I go, city doesn't invest in the stock market. What are you talking about, dude? It's tips. You take, and, like, obviously you want a much higher growth rate because that means your discount rate's good. You want a much higher investment rate because that means your discount rate's going to be higher, which means your net present value is going to be a lower amount of money. So he says to me, well, if we could come to this number, we'll have to go to court. Table, all lawyers and everything. I'm just like, oh, okay. They hit mute. They're like, shut the hell up. That's not you. And I'm like, so I'm getting yelled at, and I'm just like, all right. Like, and then, yeah, like 3 years later, I'm CFO, and now I can actually get in trouble for saying that stuff, so I should probably be, like, a lot more careful. And I was like, fine, I'll go to court. I'll go, listen, who's going to win? The city that you destroyed a historic roof on? Or, like, this tech bro company? Like, okay, let's see who this is going to be. This is going to be better. My numbers are just math. Like, we invested tips, take how much money we lost. There it is. End of story.
How long ago was this?
30. So this is like six, seven years ago.
Okay. So I'm guessing nothing ever came of that.
Oh, no. They still every so often, but let's just say the owner of that company has bigger headaches now. Oh. And little Eric in Quincy is not going to probably. Can't wait. I'm going to go to work on Monday. Solicitor is going to be sitting in my chair when I walk in my office. It's basically we have a conversation about disclosure.
Is he the seventh guy?
Yeah. Hi, Jim. If you're in here.
Right. Should we talk about something economic related? I kind of want to get you ranting on bricks a little bit.
I mean, I'm fine to keep complaining about nameless solar companies. I mean, I'm fine. That makes me happy.
Well, actually, there's another one that I kind of want to get your thoughts on. I don't know if you're paying attention when NVIDIA reported their earnings, but the way it just kind of saved the NASDAQ was something spectacular. But from, like, an economist point of view, does that worry you to see one company have that size of an impact on a market?
I mean, yeah. It does. So we have, like, we all know, like, the HHI, you know, it's that type of market control. You know, there's two sides to this, right? Like, should one company have that? Does it concern us if one company has that outside impact? Yeah, absolutely, it should, because that just what can be ventured easily can be lost easily. Mm-hmm. But what's the alternative? Like, do we force some sort of, like, regulation on it? Do we break it up? And it's like, Well, no. So sometimes it sounds sad, but it's the reality of the situation. Like, you know, I'm somebody who in my job probably says that too much than I should. But no, I mean, it shows that, you know, chips are oil now. Like, that's really what it is. It shows that type of technology, chip diplomacy, is here to stay. And I mean, that's a big reason why, you know, Taiwan. I mean, I think the best thing that protects Taiwan is abilities like that is that chip diplomacy. Because even if China takes over Taiwan, it's like they will lose the technology to make the advanced chips. That kind of
right. You can take over the factory, but the people that actually run the equipment,
yep,
not necessarily going to agree to continue doing it.
Well, and not necessarily even the people that, you know, run the equipment. It's the people that actually draw in the lines on the isolithography mm-hmm. to design the chip. That's the real brain power there.
Yeah, it's like the Dutch machine and stuff like that. Like, China, I always tell people, I'm like, China's really good at making microwaves, but they can't make supercomputers. And people like blows people's minds. I'm like, no, it's a specific tool to do that. Mm-hmm. And China just doesn't have that capability. And they're like, you know, China's labor cost is up 4 times since 2000. Like, it's wild how expensive Chinese labor is now.
Really?
I mean, that's why we're seeing onshoring. We're seeing a lot of jobs come back to Mexico, is because Chinese labor's become super expensive. They kind of now they're having population decline. They're cutting rates. They're effectively in mechanical recession right now. Mm-hmm. Whether that translates to a technical recession and then, you know, a more broadly accepted recession, I don't know. They're probably already in a recession. I don't super trust Chinese state data. That should not be a shock to anybody.
Thanks. You want to weigh in on anything here? Been a little quiet.
Yeah, no, I've just been kind of listening. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think NVIDIA this week kind of put the old globe on its back, the old meme. It was fun to see, though. I mean, you know, I wasn't surprised by any means. It seems like every time they have earnings, it's, you know, it's always bullish. And it always tends to be pulling back before that. So it's not surprising one bit. But just be kind of listening and kind of, I don't know, when Eric talks, you just kind of lay back.
I know, you just kind of let him go, right?
More tune it out is probably the safer thing for your mental health. I got to be honest.
Well, I didn't want to say that.
I mean, look at the other side of this, you know, insane PE market value of NVIDIA is it's incentivized the marketplace for competitors to come in and say, we're going to create chips. Mm-hmm. And everybody and their brother knows that, you know, Google and Samsung and Apple and everybody else is working on their own chips because they're tired of the old, you know, the old Intel AMD monopoly market.
Well, then we mentioned Taiwan, but the way TSM set up their business model, I think, is pretty brilliant. They don't do the engineering. They take the design specs from their customers and then just build it for them.
Yep.
So I love that model. Save a lot of money on R&D.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're investing all their R&D money in better manufacturing techniques and, you know, just trying to drive that circuit size down.
Yeah, I mean, it is amazing how narrow those circuits are getting. It's I mean, talk about mm-hmm. who would have thought Moore's Law would, like, still be this strongly applicable?
Six decades from when that first came out? Coming to the end, though, it's getting to the point now where we're, like, the transistor sizes are getting to, like, the atomic limits.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you're bumping up against quantum limits, but I mean, we were talking about atomic limits, you know, in the mid 90s. I grew up in Boise, so I knew a bunch of people at Micron Semiconductor, and they, you know, I knew chip designers back then, and they're talking about, hey, you know, we're really pushing the limits of physics, and that was, you know, tenfold ago.
Well, is this true? What ProShot just said there? They're talking about adding HD space on GPUs in the next few years.
Yeah, I mean, did you see that proposal from the ChatGPT, or I should say OpenAI CEO, where he's like talking about the $7 trillion chip?
Was this the guy who was fired for lying? And then
rehired?
This is like 3 days ago I saw this, so this could be true.
So that's it might be the new one?
Yeah, I mean, but no, AI, this could already be the third CEO. but yeah, I mean, that's what it is. I mean, that's a great, I mean, ProShot, like, that's such an awesome point. I think that's a great point. Like, it's a computer inside of a computer. I mean, that's really what's going to happen with, like, cubic functions when you have, like, quantum computing. Is you're basically having an algorithm that's horizontal and an algorithm that's vertical too, and you just basically that combination of those two numbers. Like, that's the thing about, like people think quantum computers are going to make their cell phone faster. And it's like, no, that's not what quantum computers doing. Quantum computers are going to solve, like, you know, what would basically be irrationally high, complicated mathematical equations just so much faster. Like, the quantum computer is not going to make your, you know, you're not going to be able to watch, you know, YouTube reels or whatever you call them, like, faster, or YouTube shorts. I'm an old man. I don't know what those little videos are called. Yeah, sure.
Just call them TikToks.
Yeah.
TikTok. There you go. I refuse to download TikTok. I had somebody go, I was so, slightly off topic. I was talking to somebody at work and they brought up something like propaganda thing, and I was like, dude, that doesn't make any sense. Like, it was something about like that video was like viral. It was like some dude coming supposedly coming across the southern border, and he was talking about like Azerbaijan and like, oh, you'll know my name. And I'm like, dude, like, you realize like we're like Azerbaijan, not to get way into Azerbaijan versus Armenia, but I'm like, you realize Azerbaijan's on our side, right? Like, they sold the seventh leader provider of natural gas to the EU. Armenia's in what do you call it, the CSTO. I'm like, this is this propaganda falls apart with any sort of understanding of the Nagorno-Karabakh war. And this dude's like, oh, really? And I'm like, yeah. Also, don't yell to, you don't talk to me about state secrets and state media. You're on TikTok, man.
You don't have any state secrets.
Yeah, like, you're on TikTok, dude. Like, the Chinese is so up your phone that they're answering your voicemails, and you got some secret state information. Like, no, be more familiar with what's going on. Like, that's one of my favorite things. Like, we hide behind certain stuff where you can just like very quickly familiarize yourself, like what's going on, like Azerbaijan and Armenia, and it ends up coming off like, oh, this person knows a lot. It's like, nah, man, I watched a 10-minute video on like TLDR on YouTube. Yeah. And, like, I know what
Karabakh is. I didn't even watch the video. I read the comments.
Dude, YouTube comments are top tier cesspool. I love it.
Oh, God, I'd stay out of there. Wanted to keep going about the quantum computers a little bit. The way I understood, I want to make sure I understand it right, because the way like a normal computer works, it's like binary, right, on, off, one. You have two states, basically. But with the quantum computer or qubit, you have multiple states. Four. How much is that? That's like exponentially increasing the processing power, right?
Yeah, so you have two ups, two downs. First up, first down. First down, first up.
Do you have to completely rewrite like all languages and computer languages in order to make use of that?
So I haven't had the chance. So there's like, and I want to sit down and do it, but there are like qubit coding simulators you can use.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to like really get into them. Like right now I'm learning G-code for 3D printing and stuff. So that,
ooh, nice.
That's like not to the third power. That's three axes. That's X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. Yes, I asked my wife for a 3D printer for our anniversary, not so I could print stupid stuff, so I can learn to code slightly better.
Right.
But yeah, anytime you move, basically you're adding axes of potential data. So like one of the funniest parts of like being an analyst in like the public sector is trying to explain that like you can only optimize on one point. Like an Excel spreadsheet, Excel's great, but Excel can only optimize on one variable, right? Now you can throw something in R and you can do like synthetic control. I mean, synthetic control is by a bad example. You can do like instrumental variable, and in theory, you would be able to optimize on 2 points, kind of, not really. Somebody will probably call me out for that later in my life. Where with quantum computing, you're going to be able to, maybe optimize isn't the right word, but you're going to be able to more quickly express possible outcomes or solves for an equation. Mm-hmm. Because you're basically at a cube function volume-wise, expanding the individual cells of information. And where binary is one and zero, you really are, so you really only have two options.
Right.
You really technically have four. I mean, some people argue that it's cubed because your root is zero. It's probably a little bit beyond my understanding of mathematics. But what's really scary about this, guys, is have you guys ever heard like store for later data?
No. I'm guessing that's basically what every company is doing with all these server farms they're building.
Dude, 100% right. So like, even though your passwords, so there's this quantum computing test they do where quantum computing, like how do you know quantum computing is better than your traditional binary computer? And what that is can it solve an equation that a regular computer could not practically solve? We've hit that, where it would take a computer like, no, I'm not joking, like 34 million years to solve some of the equations that quantum computers are solving in, you know, an hour or less.
Yeah. The answer is 42.
The answer is always 42. So they end up, a lot of nations are doing, bad actors, non-state agencies, is that they're storing all your password information, all your user account informations. And even though, like, you know, you have to use letters and numbers and special characters and blood and stuff to, you know, every new password.
Right.
Because from a binary standpoint, you never be able to crack that in a realistic time frame.
Mm-hmm.
Quantum computer is going to be able to crack that instantaneously. So like North Korea is just storing a bunch of information, hoping to crack it later as quantum computing gets better and better, which is kind of scary.
It started in World War II where they would store the encrypted messages that were intercepted.
so that when they finally cracked the Enigma, they were able to go back and read those messages, yeah, in the past tense, but then get additional insights on, oh, hey, this is what was said. Mm-hmm. You know, even if it was something from 3 weeks ago, it's going to have relevant information in there about, you know, sources and methods that, you know, the events passed. So then you go back into Five Eyes in the 80s, and they started just hoovering up all of the encrypted data that was passing across the telecommunications wires and then what then became the internet. And so, you know, there's treasure troves of data in Maryland and other places like that where they've said, hey, we have all this encrypted communication between bad actor one and bad actor two. We can't read it, but we know in a few years we're going to crack this algorithm. And then we're going to go back and read it. So there's your stored for later.
Longtime fans of the show should be familiar with the lender formerly known as Sue Pullen. And I'm pleased to announce that she's back, fresh off a rebrand and ready to help as Sue Mackey. Sue is a certified mortgage advisor at Fairway Independent Mortgage, an equal housing lender who focuses on finding the right product for you and your needs. She has over 20 years of experience helping thousands of homeowners. Whether it's purchasing, refinancing, or even a reverse mortgage, Sue will help. Sue's licensed in 36 states now, so reach out and let Sue Mackey it happen for you. The best way to reach her is to just give her a call at 520-977-7904 or in an email, spullen@fairwaymc.com. Fairway Independent Mortgage has an MLS number of 2289. Sue Mackey has an MLS number of 206048. That email again, spullen@fairwaymc.com. And that phone number is 520-977-7904. Shoot Sue an email and let her know she needs to update that address.
Well, yeah. I think even like specifically like the Enigma, my understanding was that they were able to crack most of the messages. It just took so long that by the time they were able to do it, everything was outdated. And because of the mechanisms that the Enigma managed to like change the keys the way it did and there, how many different permutations of that was, it was impractical to be able to figure out how to do it without the actual machine.
Yeah, we eventually just stole one off a submarine that they tried to scuttle.
Right. Nothing like that movie,
by the way.
No, it's just, it's like one of the biggest reasons the U.S. was able to keep its secrets during World War II is we used like a Navajo-based language. Mm-hmm. So you can use like a there's very few non-Semitic, non-Indo-European languages in the world. I mean, there's very, very few. We just happen to have one with a very readily available population that spoke it. Like we looked out, like geography won that out for us.
Right.
I'm surprised nobody is up there vacuuming up all those Papua New Guinea tribes.
You've heard my rant on that. I just not Papua New Guinea, but North Sentinel. Yeah, well, yes, yeah, that's my favorite rant of all time. But no, I mean it is fascinating because it just shows information's new oil, and it really like I don't know. I mean, I'm going to sound horrible saying this, but like I don't see how information's never not going to be.
I feel like information has been the thing that people who have wealth value more than they value their wealth because the information is how they compound that.
Yeah. I mean, like one of the pillars of economics is, you know, everybody behaves rationally given the information they know. And the more information you know, the more rational and you know, more logical you can be in business sense actions.
I think I broke that model today. I did not act rationally today.
when your economic needs are taken care of, what becomes more valuable? Time.
Time, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's one of the ways that I've read a couple. Like, I'm not a huge fan into, like, socioeconomics. Like, no, I'm not against the field. I'm just not somebody who, like, spend a lot of time. But I do very much like behavioral economics. And some of the ways they say, like, the best ways to have people care about the environment and stuff is to, you know, like you said, Bear, like, satisfy economic needs. Because then you're thinking in the future, you want your life to be better. You know, if you're, like, you know, it's horrible stuff going around, like, the Democratic Republic of Congo. Where you have 15% of cobalt is mined, artisanal mines, you know. People literally grabbing radioactive cobalt out of the ground. You know, if you're somebody who cares about the environment in the long run, if your economic needs, yeah.
They're just going out there and picking it up?
Yeah, it's horrible.
Wow.
Yeah. Electric, until we figure out like silicate batteries, which are pretty close to electric cars, are basically the rich world making the poor world pay to feel good about saving the environment that we think is hurting the poor world. Like, let me tell you know, sea level rise in 100 years is not as deadly as radioactive cobalt. Just
yeah,
controversial take by Eric there. No, let me tell you something weird. So when they were trying to figure this out, so back in 2004, they went down there. I part of my master thesis was on this, and they went down there, and they were like, all right, we want to figure out how much radioactive exposure these people are getting. And I wrote a very long, complicated email after I got yelled at by somebody at work explaining my position on electric cars. And it was so beautifully, it was like, I wrote it as if I was trying to publish it. And they responded with a link to a local newspaper ad saying electric cars are cheaper to maintain. And I've never, it was the greatest troll move of all time. I've never been angry in my life. I was so impressed with that response. but I can forward this to you because it's one of my pride and joys of Eric being insane. And yeah, so they go down there. They give Geiger counters out, all right? So they're like, all right, let's measure radiation. And after one day, one 12-hour workday, they were the workers received more radiation than's permissible in an entire year in Europe and in the U.S. By labor standards. So they threw away the Geiger counters. That was their solution.
Trying to remember what the... I think our lifetime exposure allowance when I was in the military on the nuke sub was like 5 millirem or something like ridiculously small.
Which is I think that's like 1.5 times.
Sorry, 5 rem. I think it was the total.
Yeah, I think that's like 1.5 times the amount you get exposures flying like from like Boston to LA.
Right.
So the only other time a state entity sponsored the measure of radiation and then threw away the Geiger counters when... It did when they were going off the chart too much was the Chernobyl meltdown.
Yeah.
We shouldn't be subsidizing Chernobyl meltdown levels of exposure to radiation, which is what we're doing right now with subsidizing electric cars. Wow. That's what we're doing. Just goes up my ass, to be honest.
Damn, I thought I'd get you ranting on China, but
yeah.
I can if you want. I mean, like, I have a lot of opinions on China. They're all sad. They're just kind of makes me sad.
ProShot says they got wolves now that resist cancer. Where are they at?
Chernobyl.
Steal their blood.
Yeah.
How do they know that? Like, how much data? Is this some guy out there, like, shooting wolves? And, like, you need a lot of data to come up to that conclusion. I've seen that study. I'm with you. I get it. But what psychopath is hunting, like, wolves in the Red Forest? Like,
or they're just out there going, hey, how are these things still alive? Oh. Okay, cool. They have adapted. All right. Yeah. I mean, out where I'm at, because I'm in the middle of nowhere, Montana. Awesome. You know, we talk about, hey, you want to talk to a real environmentalist? Go talk to a farmer or a rancher. Because
yeah.
Here's somebody whose, you know, family's been on the land for generations, and their whole goal is to maintain the land in a manner that it goes down to their future generations. So, right. You know, yep. To me, that's, you know, the ultimate environmentalist, but I'm pretty biased.
No, I'm a city boy. Don't get me wrong. But my wife, she's her family has a ranch in rural West Virginia on the Ohio River. So like Western West Virginia, hit a little south. Yeah. They give way more crap about the environment than any of the hippies I went to school with. Are you kidding me?
I just want to see Eric on a horse.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
I would love that.
I actually really like it. It's really relaxing, but I just sit quietly in a chair.
I probably can't stand horses. They terrify me.
Most cows scare the crap out of me.
Cows?
Yeah, I just scare the absolute crap out of me. They're so delicious. They are delicious, but I love my father-in-law. Like where all my in-laws are great. They put up with me, which is absolutely crazy. They have like 800 head of cattle. All right. And we're in the manger. And I'm like, oh, dude, I like little baby animals, man. I think it's awesome. Though I will say, I saw about 2 months before I got married, I watched my wife castrate a cow. So, like, that was very threatening. That was...
A cow.
Yeah. I was like, oh. And my father-in-law says to me, he goes, Eric, it's not just that she knows how to do it. It's that she has the equipment to do it.
And she's good at it.
She was good at it, man. It was impressive. It was scary.
She's over there nudging your elbow. You see how, like, she didn't hesitate?
Sitting there like I wanted like a gator. So I'm like, I don't know if I want to do this. So he walks through the manger and the cows, you know, eating all their stuff. And as he walks, they pull their head back. And he's like, I go, I'm sorry, I just saw the comment about we're talking about cows in this. So,
I missed that.
I walk around the entrance because I'm like, dude, I'm not walking in front of these cows. And I'm not a huge guy. I'm like, I'm 6'4", but I'm maybe like 200 pounds. I'm not like, even though no humans is going to be able to take on a cow. But I'm like, so I walk through and my father-in-law was like, why'd you walk around? I was like, I didn't know when those cows got like irritated. It just hit me in the side, just broke my entire body. Like, I don't want to risk that, man. I like my life. I don't need everything broken on whatever side of the body that like this 6 IQ animal that like we harvest for meat is like, it's gonna do.
I've heard people talk about the thing jumping over like 6-foot fences and shit.
Yeah, they're
that's
crazy.
Terrifying.
No, the worst one is I'm driving down there. I look over at my wife and I said, "Hey Tiff, so how many you got 800 cows? So how many bulls do you have?" And she's like, "How many bulls do you think I have?" And I'm like, "I don't know, dude. I can replace your alternator. I grew up in a mechanic shop. I'm not the best hand. I can file your taxes. And I can fix your alternator. Those are like the two things God gave me. I can reach stuff on high shelves. All right." And she goes, "Why don't you ask my grandfather?" Now, Tiff's grandfather is like one of my favorite people, minister, Korean War vet, minister. Like, guy's awesome. And so I decide to, you know, ask my wife's father-in-law. And he's like, looks at me and goes, "One, Eric. We have one bull. You don't need that many bulls." And
he's just a busy bull.
Yeah. And, you know, because they cycle through. They don't have, like, I forget what they call it, but they're like, they don't do the full herd. They don't get the full herd pregnant. Like, I don't know if there's a term for that. Like, but yeah, like, oh, that bull is pissed off all the time. Like, I went over and I'm like, "Hey, I'm going to go look at the bull." And he's just angry. I'm like, "Dude, what are you angry about? What is your life? Like,
you're going to fuck all these cows.
You got to keep your balls." Yeah, freaking asshole bull. But yeah, he, one of their old bulls, my father-in-law had to shoot because it jumped over the fence. It was just like running around through the woods.
And, like, mad cow.
Idiot me is like, "Oh, did you catch him? Did you like lasso him?" He's like, "No, I shot him with a 30-06. He's a freaking bull on the loose." they let me marry their daughter. That's wild.
No. That's more of a Mongo moment. No. Don't shoot him. It'll just make him mad.
Damn it, CFs. I wish you could load some videos on here. Shit. I wish you could too.
My I saw cow tipping. I made a cow tipping joke. My father was like wicked angry at me.
That's the, like, thing, dude, he doesn't, like, joke about.
I didn't think that was a thing. Farmers don't like it ever. No, but it's weird. Like, I would love to, like, you could stick a GoPro to me, and me on a farm is the weirdest thing. Or a ranch, I should say. It's like, I don't know what's going on. Like, I'm like, the hell are all these animals around here? Why is there no, like, police sirens and stuff? This freaks me out. I want to hear crime going on.
Did you guys ever see that show with Gary Busey? They had, like, some guy that was just, like, hanging out with Gary Busey. This is after he went insane and had, like, the brain injury. But one of the episodes, he's out there, they're trying to fix global warming, and they're doing it by trying to stop cows from producing methane. So the one guy is out there distracting the farmers, and Gary Busey's sneaking behind the cows trying to shove this giant cork up their ass.
It's going to die?
This whole time he's doing it, the farmers are there, "What is your friend doing?" Just ignore him. Ignore him.
Yeah, I mean, there's your economic side of it, is that if you actually look at the hard data, cattle in natural pasture, so grass-fed, grass-raised cattle, are actually net carbon sink.
Oh, so it's all the grain.
They put more carbon into the ground than they release.
So ones that are, like, corn-fed?
There's corn-fed, and then there's the feedlot issue, and feedlots are a whole other environment.
Yeah, so it's like my wife's farm, like, that's all, they just graze, man. It's amazing how much food they can eat, but they got, I think they have, like, 3,000 acres or something. I think, like, 850 might be what they, like, actively use, and they actually have some natural gas wells out there too. Way different.
So they've got a lot of moisture. They've got some pretty rich land then, if they're running that heavy a concentration of cattle.
Bear, you should see this grass, dude. I'll be there a week and the grass is like a foot taller. I'm like, it's like nitrogen or something. They're like, no, it's just the way it is. But they have to. Literally,
it's good soil that's well taken care
of. You know, it's funny. My wife's grandfather, you know, like I said, he's a minister. He's a big believer in that kind of, like, oh, this is the way we're supposed to live. Like, this is, you treat the land well, the land treats you well. It's funny. I said to him one time. So my wife is a horse. She's a Belgian workhorse. This thing's a unit, and they retired it, and it has this little. They have a little 86 acre pasture where I'm from. That would house 100,000 people, and so. Another stupid thing I've said to my wife's grandfather, I was like, hey, what would happen if, like, wouldn't you be nervous, like, a bear attacking the horse?
Me too, Max.
he looks at me and goes, "Eric, I'd have a bear rug if a black bear attacked that horse. It would stop his face." And I was like, oh, I can tell you about crackheads. That's my wild animal that I know about. But everything else, not aware of.
Someone was asking what part of Texas are you referring to there?
For me?
Somebody. I don't know who mentioned Texas.
I didn't mention.
No, I'm in southern Montana. So central, south and central Montana, not Texas. I think we've only been talking about, Montana, West Virginia, and Ohio.
I didn't think Texas was in there, but I don't know. Texans always want to work Texas in there.
Yeah, Texans do love Texans.
I'm pretty sure CP's in Texas, but interesting about him is he trades from, I assume, from his work equipment. I've seen pictures of him working in a, Bobcat or whatever. He's got the laptop out there and everything.
I've seen posts. I swear I've seen posts from Egg Trader doing trades on his cell phone while he's running the tractor.
There's a few of them. I think there's a couple of them there. Somebody else was saying they do that too. We should probably talk about something economic related though. So,
dealer's choice.
How about, I don't know, what do you guys think? Should we talk about trading bonds or should we talk about the de-dollarization fears that are going out there?
I'll let Eric pick.
De-dollarization. Just so angers me. So 87% of trades are in dollar denominations. That is.
So you don't believe that China's yuan is gathering strength?
Dude, I gave so enraged. One of my worst jokes I ever did at any sort of conference was I had a giant chart up there, and it was like, this is dollar. I was talking about the dollar dominance, and I had this chart and it showed the yuan or renminbi, whatever the hell they call it today. And I had it over time. Look, they were competing. I'm sorry, wrong chart. Click it, and then I had you couldn't even see the yuan to the dollar, and it landed horribly. It landed so bad, because I either sold it like crap, or they actually thought I was being serious. I'm like, the freaking dollar has never been. The dollar's increasing in strength, because the euro is kind of weird. Who would have guessed that non-unified fiscal policy would result in crappy monetary policy? Oh wait, everybody involved in the euro when it originally launched. How do you have Germany and Greece using the same currency? You freaking had Italy and Greece using inflation taxes to fund their government, which is fine. And you got Germany that has a 50% marginal propensity of consumption. If you give a German a dollar, he saves 50 cents. And they're like, let's combine our currency. Why? Who did that help?
Not Germany.
It's better for trade. Hey, Europe, you've been driving around trading with each other for 1,000 years. It seems to be going just fine. Oh, and then who became the center of your entire economy? London. The only place not using the dollar. Who's your second one? Switzerland. Also not using your freaking currency. And I'm like, why did you do this? Don't get in bed with France and Germany on freaking fiscal policy. You came out of the 1900s and you got in bed with the two people who were broken the entire 1900s. Currency is supposed to be tied to what is now Ferguson called money? Trust inscribed. France is on its fifth republic. They're their fifth government. Their fifth swing at republic. You want to tie a currency to that? In Germany? I feel like I can't rant too much on Germany. Just Germany in the 1900s. What are we doing here? What are we doing here? Acting like this is some fucking substitution to this. You got the yen. You got triple M over in Japan. All right, you got the country's getting taken over by robots because they don't bring in immigrants because they're horrible to immigrants moving in there. Their population, they get maybe 50, yeah, right, every 50 Japanese people who die, there's a third of a baby born. the currency's falling apart. And then so what you're left with? You're left with England, which had 68 million people and a GDP of $3.5 trillion. And you got the pound. Pound's wicked heavy. That's fine. Totally get that. And then you got the U.S. And you're like, what about Switzerland? Switzerland's don't look at anything. We don't want anybody looking at anything. Nobody's questioning why Switzerland hasn't had inflation the last 2 years. Why is that not a major news story? Everybody's like, I'm on.
Wait. They haven't?
Yeah, Switzerland's inflation's been it's 1% over a year or so.
They manage that?
Because they do shady stuff all the time. It's look up. If you look up countries with the highest GDP per capita, Ireland's up there. Do you know what countries has no money? Ireland, who some people, they have a major political party that thinks they're still at war with England, relies on the RAF to patrol the airspace because they don't have money to fund a military. But I'm supposed to believe they have $110,000 per capita? Nah, it's a freaking tax loophole that they allowed happen And they just like, we're like, okay with it. And you're just taking total GDP from those revenue sources and dividing it by population. But like the average Irish person isn't like doing better off because of that, by evidence of that, right. they can't protect their own airspace. Like, it's a country. You should be like, patrol your water, make sure you control your airspace. I feel like that's like minimum one, two things to be in a country. And you have a country with a large political population that thinks there's still an active civil war with England. Be like, yo, RAF, can you cover my stuff? That'd be if like Iran, oh no, not right now, but if like 10 years ago, Iran was like, yo, Iraq, can you cover my airspace? Like, what are you talking about? Like, fucking insane. And then I'm supposed to sit here and like hear these jabronis with the freaking political science and journalism degrees. Try and tell me that the dollar's dying. I'm like, where is it dying? Somebody explicitly show me something that shows the dollar's dying. Like, yo, China poured a lot of concrete. What does that have to do with the value of the dollar?
How much of the China's share increase is because that Russia is not allowed to transact with anybody else anymore?
Yeah, I mean, so it's funny history about the ruble is that like we never allowed to be traded. Even, I don't know, there's a whole thing about the ruble wasn't a true currency, like in terms of like inflation and transactionary experience during the Soviet Union. Like inflation wasn't expressed in the devaluation of a ruble. In fact, it was like more expressed as like the amount of time it takes to wait in line. I know a great economist and she wrote her PhD paper on that. It was excellent dissertation. So like it never really existed, to be honest. So like then you had 30 years of it kind of being openly traded, which is crazy to think about. It was only 30 years from like the fall of the Soviet Union to these massive sanctions that were placed on Russia. So it never really had a chance to kind of dominate the market. So you're right. Like they were exchanging with China, but even China's been cautious about doing too much pure exchange with Russia, because even though China and Russia have been trying to come up with this new system, like to replace SWIFT, it's not working. It's just because I'm going to let you guys know a little secret. China and Russia aren't the richest consumer market in the world.
Right.
It's like two people. It's like two little kids trading different like powder to make lemonade. It's like, yeah, that's great, but until the guy buys it, you're just again trading lemonade powder. I don't get, it's like I hear people yell at me, they'll be like, yeah, the U.S. shouldn't have a trade deficit. I'm like, bitch, who are we trading with who has more money than us? Like, who? Like, of course we have.
Makes sense.
Yeah, like, we are the rich guys. We are so stupid. The U.S. is so stupidly wealthy. We're 5% GDP growth. All right, right now. So that means if we hold that for a year, our GDP is going to be like the GDP growth, not the entire GDP, just the growth would be like the sixth largest country, the seventh largest in the world. Just that. Like, we grow bigger than countries dream of growing. Like, it's freaking nuts. I mean, it's...
That's a year?
Yeah, so we're at 5 points. So when you, I mean, you guys know this, but when you hear GDP, like, well, third quarter GDP just means it grows at... That if it would maintain that growth rate for a year, it would be 5.2%. So 1.25% GDP growth. You know, you talk about $500 billion just in one quarter of new economic activity added, which is just, that's a lot of money. That is, and we act like it's nothing. We act like, oh, yeah, it's no big deal. It's like, dude, we added over, like the average worker added something like $1,200 in added economic activity above everything else in a 3 month period.
That's how long can that keep going like that?
We don't know. See, I'm like, people be like, oh, you want the most GDP growth. I don't know if you do. Like 10% year over year GDP growth in the US would actually have like some real negative effects, like in terms of asset growth and sort of like deflation of the dollar that would make transaction become so progressively more expensive. Like dollars wouldn't be able to deflate in value, or in this case, I guess inflate in value, because we're talking on the transaction side, quick enough if you have that rapid growth. So it means like any delayed transaction would be jacking up the price. You essentially have to continuously jack up the price, which it's ironic because it doesn't like, hey, Eric, is that what inflation is? I'm not saying the dollars become more valuable. I'm saying the price of the transaction becomes more valuable because the dollars you're exchanging are gaining value. So that transaction gains value if the dollar amount stays the same. So you would be able to lower prices quick enough, and that would like kind of hurt your economy. I don't know how sustainable it is. Part of me says it's 5% is great, but you know, historically 3% is considered pretty stable growth. We've actually, since the end of the shutdown side of the pandemic, we've been doing pretty good on GDP growth. So maybe 5% could be like an abnormality, or but I don't think it's going to go like 5.2% of 5.2% to like 9% then drop down to like -1. I think you're going to see it like kind of 4% kind of, you know, level off maybe the 2-3% range.
Stabilize in it.
Makes sense. All right, that was a good rant.
Not very good.
Is everything I hoped it would be?
I'm sorry.
Thank you for that. You. Anybody else have anything they want to ask?
I did have a question going back to Ireland. For a long time, I know Google and Apple were pretty much, you know, laundering all their worldwide earnings through Ireland. Is that still going on, or?
Yeah, so they closed some of the tax loopholes. So I'm sure you guys are familiar with what they did, but basically, like, they didn't want to get U.S. taxes. So what they figured out is that they could form, like, Apple Ireland. Mm-hmm. And then Apple Ireland would, you know, like, Apple Germany and all the other ones. And then...
Yeah, all the international partners
their
profits.
Didn't they do that just recently with, like, a Bermuda or somewhere, too? Where they're, like, that's little one company owns all the IP of, like, this massive corporation?
Yep. And what they would do is they would lease out to, like, Apple Germany. They would charge the trade rights and the copyright to use the Apple logo. So say like an iPhone costs $200, they would charge $199.99 for the use of the Apple product. So Apple Germany would have no profits, but it would go to Apple Ireland. Apple Ireland would have this really, really low tax rate. This is way more complicated than this. But then Ireland was trying to induce more international investment. So they formed this company in Bermuda that was like, taking the profits from Ireland and then reinvesting them in using this like extra national credit, and somehow that makes the average Irish worker wealthier. Notice in none of that equation that I talk about the average Irish, and I'm half Irish. This is my fellow countrymen. Like nothing, the average. Like it did help the average Irish worker because these companies had to, you know, create businesses in there. But at the end of the day, they're not being productive. Which I again cite the fact that they can't protect their own coastline. How crappy are a country are you if you can't protect your own coastline? Like work with me. You don't have a boat. Like six guys haven't gotten together and invested in a boat. Like come on.
I mean, shit, I've seen.
Come on, you know, we got a skiff and a couple of shotguns.
Crazy billionaires in Canada just buy like old U.S. destroyers. Like they're out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that hard. It's like it really just couple. I mean, they're great fishermen. Like most of my family was fishermen before they immigrated over here. What's a Navy besides a fishing boat with a 5-inch artillery gun on it? Like, let's be honest.
Yeah, pretty much. That's about what I remember.
About $1 billion.
Kyle, I didn't know you were in the submarine service.
Oh yeah, did 6 years. God, six long, long years.
So I've met one submariner in my life, and it's he's dating my cousin, and he's literally one of the most interesting people in the world. Is that why you don't get rattled about anything? Because he's also the calmest person I've ever met.
I mean, it probably helps. Like, I mean, I remember like first patrol, like staring up at the hatch while we're like, you know, 200 meters underwater or whatever it was, thinking like, you know, if this thing actually, does something really actually hit the fan, like we're all dead. And you kind of have to come to grips with that. Like, there's just nothing you can do about it.
What the hell? God love you. Well, thank you for doing that, man.
They have these, they have like this escape equipment, and like we'd have to practice the drills every now and then. They call them stanky hoods. It's like just this thing that you put over your head, and then like you're supposed to yell ho 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 as you go up the hatch, and you can only get three people in there at a time. And if you're down like that deep, like they got to pop your eardrums so they don't explode as soon as you open the hatch to leap out, and you've got like literally 45 seconds to like flood the container or the part that you're in, get the hatch open and get to the surface before you die of the bends. So like, that's not happening. Let's be honest. And plus those hoods, those were from like legit, like the first fucking submarine ever made. Like, I'm pretty sure they bought one order of these things and they never updated them again. Like, yeah, these are worthless.
Yeah. I'm like wicked obsessed with like, people who do saturation diving and stuff like that. It just sounds all terrifying. Just
like those guys that do like the free dive or like they just take a huge deep breath and just fall or float to the bottom.
No, that also scares the crap out of me. Cause you ever see like a video of what somebody's lungs look like during that? Just don't. Yeah. Crazy people.
Saturate. The movie, The Blue Hole.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So saturation diving refers to like, you know, your body can only absorb so much nitrogen. So you saturate the body. You inhale this thing called HELOC, which is like helium, nitrogen, and oxygen.
Trimix,
yeah, exactly. And you basically flood the amount of nitrogen in your body, so you don't have you only have to do one major decompression, but you can like go down like a couple hundred meters and work on like oil lines and stuff on the bottom of the ocean without.
No, thank you.
No, yeah. Like right.
But if you your decompression takes days.
Hey, we do have a. Let's get this question answered, and then we can probably wrap things up here. So, ProShot TV wants to know thoughts on Delta hedging as a major market mover.
I don't know who wants to go first.
I think the probably traders should go better.
So, like ProShot, are you saying like independent of your portfolio hedging against Delta, or are you saying Delta is part of like a larger?
I think it's talking about like market makers who. Or Delta hedging their portfolio or Delta hedging their exposure, like how much that moves the markets.
Yeah, I don't know inherently how much it moves like the market directly. It certainly does because I think it's an information signaling. I think that's the biggest thing about Delta hedging. So when I was like taking derivatives in college, like one of the things you know we looked at was like theta neutral portfolio management. I think that affects markets a little better. Not better, I shouldn't say. A little more dramatic. It's a more pronounced thing on the theta level. Delta's really interesting though. Like, if Delta is part of a larger strategy employed by hedge funds, I think I really think it's like an information signal on what that company's trying to. I think it's less about what that company's trying to do and more what that company thinks is going to happen that will trigger the need for that type of hedging. Does it move the market? I don't know. I think inherently Delta hedging. Is a company accepting that something major may happen in the market that's going to force it to kind of like, you know, go a little defensive towards one side. As you know, if you're an individual who's doing Delta, you know, you're trying to do Delta hedging, I think it has to be part of like some greater action because, you know, I'm just assuming nobody who does it at our level is big enough to really.
I don't think you can. Think you can because you just. It changes so quickly. You're constantly having to adjust it. Yeah, retail definitely can.
Yeah.
Like, that's got to be, like, algorithmic type stuff. I don't know. Banks, do you have any thoughts on that? You probably look more at Delta than the rest of us.
I mean, I look at Delta in the sense of the way that we traded on futures. I've never really looked at it on the way that we have done options on portfolio-wise. Just because I've never really... cared, to be honest with you, and the only reason I say that is because it doesn't really bother me on the effect of how I trade it. When you're looking at like Delta hedging in the portfolio, I mean, my assumption is that most portfolios want to be Delta neutral, which you know, again, you're basically, you know, you're getting your position to a Delta on a specific asset at Delta neutral. But I don't know how that would affect. My trading, you know, whatsoever, but in the way that it moves the market, I would say that it would have to move the market in some fashion because you're going to have to be putting it into positions and portfolio wise to get to Delta neutral. If that's your goal on that, you know, portfolio.
Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question? Probably not. That's about the best we can do though.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, retail can, I mean, it's, you know, that's something that's kind of over my head just in the sense of I've never really looked at it that way though.
I remember talking to Eric a little bit about Delta hedging. And I think he actually mentioned that gamma hedging was actually more something to look into. Let's see. Yeah. He says he's seeing the same thing. We don't look at how futures move based on market makers' portfolios and their exposure and specific stocks, et cetera. That's what we're technically talking about. Gamma, yeah. Vanna, charm. What is charm?
Time to Delta.
Time to Delta. Okay. Thank you. I've not heard that one before.
Yeah, so actually Pro is working on some cool stuff with the option side of it. And I think that I think it would be cool once it's done to have him on here and kind of talk through.
I've already asked. Yeah. He's he said he's willing to do it once he's got his website and stuff up and running.
I think that'd be great.
Yeah. Yeah, because some of the stuff he was sharing the other night with the strategy development call, man, there's some really cool stuff he's doing. All right, we got anything else for tonight, or should we wrap this thing up?
Wrap it up.
All right, let's do it. All right, folks, I think that's going to do it for today's episode. I'd like to say thank you to Eric, Banks, and Bear for joining me on this fine evening, and everyone listening who stuck around to the end.
please show our panelists some love. Check out their links in the show notes. Remember to check out that combined Discord where you can trade with Baba and Banks live every Friday morning on the free side. You can listen in live to these recordings. You can even compete in our Friday End Period challenges. We'll be back soon with another exciting episode, hopefully as impressive as Eric's hatred of bricks. But until that day, smash that 5-star rating and have a great day. This podcast is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It does not constitute financial or investment advice and should not be construed as such. The hosts, guests, and contributors of this podcast are not licensed financial advisors, brokers, or professionals. Any trading or investment decisions made based on the content of this podcast are solely at the listener's discretion and risk. Trading and investing in financial markets carry inherent risks, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Listeners should conduct their own research and seek advice from qualified financial professionals before making any financial decisions. The views, opinions, and information shared in this podcast are those of the individual contributors and do not necessarily reflect the views or policies of the podcast creators or associated organizations. Produced by China Shop Productions.